Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is that time of the week. And actually, if you're used to it on Friday, it's actually going to be on Thursday this week. Because I'm still just trying to find the juiciest stuff I can for the Zac Efron thing. And I have so many notes that I talked about before where all the notes that I had and all the tips, and I'm going through it all because there's a lot of individual private names that I can't put out there. And like, there's literally 100 different entries that I have about it. So it's just taking me a minute to go through it. But in the meantime, what we have for you is a little, like I said, true crime time with Jen. Jen, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing great. And I like this new trend of ours where we're doing this Hollywood thing. Unsolved murders. And, we're going to talk about that in a second. As is our custom, I do have one question about Delphi. And I am looking at it more frequently than I used to. And so then, I find myself on Reddit. There was something, somebody brought up an interesting point. And because what we do know from the state police guy, Carter or whatever, is that, he has said that he looks forward to the day that he can tell the public some certain things. And that he was certain up to 100% that the killer was nearby or in the room or watching the press conference.
Correct.
And he also said that he knows the killer did what he did because of power. Because the killer didn't think the police would change their strategy. So this person posits that maybe the killer has taunted the police through letters or emails. Serial killers have done that. And the ones that I think of successful, like Zodiac, I mean, that went through the press rather than straight to the police, right? I think.
Yeah, the Zodiac, and then BTK did it.
BTK got caught doing it, right?
Yes, in the end, it was his demise.
And
you know why? It's because in the end, he started sending it directly to police. He sent it to law enforcement. It was on a floppy disk, and he didn't think they could trace it, and technology caught up to him.
Yeah, because it had some kind of digital footprint or something like that.
It did.
What? Was it BTK? Is that the one with the MapQuest thing that they got busted on? Or was it somebody else?
There had to be someone else. On BTK, he had called the law enforcement agency and asked them, if I send you a floppy disk, can you trace it? And they said, no, of course not. And they allowed him to send it in. And then, of course, when they received it, they traced him.
There was a case, and I will find it, but... So they were taunting the police or something like that, and the police had a suspect in mind or something like that, and there was a map. It was this MapQuest time. This is before Google Maps, and they had, like, the police wanted to see how many people had put in from the city. I guess the body was found out in the country or something. How many people from the city to this country, this place, like if they had used MapQuest or something like that, and one person had done MapQuest from this city to the other city, and so they were able to identify who the killer was from that.
Yeah, that's very smart.
Yeah, well, and also like the whole Fitbit thing. I mean, look at how many crimes have been solved because of the Fitbits, because people forget to take them off.
Yeah, definitely. When Molly went missing in the cornfields, they looked for her through the Fitbit. They didn't exactly find her, but I mean, all the technology is definitely catching up to the criminals, and they hate it.
Yeah, I don't think that the killers, they just forget to take the Fitbit off, and the next thing the police can track where that Fitbit's been and what time it's been there, and you're just giving yourself up like that. So do we think that the Delphi killer has communicated with the police?
I think it's possible, because you had Carter come out and he was very angry, and the press conference was sort of out of nowhere. We had not heard of any updates until Carter came out angry. So if someone is talking about, did the killer taunt the police? Were there letters sent in? Did they finally receive something that made them think that the Delphi killer was, you know, kind of poking fun at them that they haven't solved this yet. I mean, to me, it's plausible.
Yeah, you know, and then...
And I'll tell you why. It's because suddenly all this information that has been held so close to the vest that they have not talked about for 2 years, it is now pouring out, and there has been mention of a letter or some type of communication. It could have been, I doubt it was an email. I'm thinking more it's a mailed letter so that it's not traceable. But something about girls being posed, something about the power kick, if all of that is true, and those letters were received, and that's the reason why the information is leaking out now, is because more Leos have seen that letter.
One of the things that's interesting to me, that it seems to be a topic on Reddit for this a lot, is that the police are being very tight-lipped about everything because they don't want the points in a certain direction, because it's, you know, there is a high risk of vigilante action in this case, I think.
Absolutely. And that's why when people ask me to name suspects, I won't do it, because I know they're going to go type them into whatever search engine, and then they're going to try to take vigilante action. They're going to go over there, harass them. They're going to try to hunt them down. And all it does is either spook off, you know, the right suspect, or you're going to ruin someone's life that is not the suspect.
Yeah, you know, and you know, if you do that, I mean, murdering a bad guy is still murder. You know, I mean,
well, yeah, I mean, why do you want to go sit in prison, you know, for a murder? Just let law enforcement handle it.
Yeah, it just, it's a fascinating case just because of the fact that, you know, where they,
it's fascinating that it is so completely heinous, and yet they won't touch on it because they don't want the community to panic. They don't want fear. And after 2 years, like you said, they cling to this evidence. But to me, they need to release just a little bit more, you know, 20 seconds, 30 more seconds of that video, or maybe some audio. It doesn't have to be the most horrendous parts, but just more parts of it that showcases his personality, more of his voice. What is he like? You know, does he get angry immediately, or was he a certain way to them and then he got angry? You know, we need more traits. If they hold on to this evidence forever, then it's just going to be a cold case with a bunch of evidence that went nowhere.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I also saw mentioned was that perhaps the communication was via phone. Because then, you know, because maybe law enforcement, you know, they had this, the suspect, the sketch, and it was this older person. And then all of a sudden, you know, 2 years later, they make it a young person. And perhaps, you know, somebody called in. And then they said, oh, you know, this guy is a little bit younger than we thought. So then, you know, it matches the new sketch, but the one that was, you know, drawn just after the crime.
Yeah, but then you have the witnesses in the beginning saying that first sketch that was rendered was who they believed they saw all along. So,
but
I'm not sure.
How about this, though, for just, you know, if the witness contributed to the bad sketch, right? Saying, oh, it, you know, looked like this person, looks like this person, you know, it looks like this, and they were in reality the killer, then all of a sudden then the police say, wait a second, this witness gave us some really, really bad information, so now we're going to release a picture that looks a lot like this person. Kind of that's the new direction.
Ooh, wouldn't that be a spin if it's the actual witness that is an accomplice or perhaps the murderer? And
yeah,
they spun them in another direction on purpose. Wow.
Yeah, for 2 years. And then, you know, the police said, okay, this isn't really adding up. Maybe it's this witness that gave us the bad description, and now we're going to use this picture that looks a lot like the witness. I don't know. That's something to think about. Okay, now that we have covered Delphi for yet another week, let's talk about our Hollywood murder. And this is one of my favorites. And there was actually a blind that I did a long time ago, and I revealed it a long time ago, about not the actual murder, but something that happened that kind of led up to the murder. And I am talking right now about Lana Turner and Cheryl Crane, who's Lana's daughter, and the murder of Johnny Stompanato. We're just gonna call him Johnny from now on. So why don't you tell us a little bit about this?
Okay, so you have Lana Turner. She was the 1950s little film noir golden Hollywood actress. I mean, she was the actress of the time, one of the most highest paid in the United States. And she had a daughter named Cheryl Crane, and the daughter was 14. The daughter ends up stabbing Lana's boyfriend, who was Johnny at the time. Apparently, Johnny had come over to the house on April 4th at 8 p.m. in 1958, and there was an argument. And it was only a couple of days after an Academy Award show, and we'll get more into that, but he comes over and he gets into it with her, and the daughter feels like the mother is threatened, and I guess she stabs him. There's three different stories on what could have possibly happened. I guess the most notable is that Cheryl stabbed him. Another one is that, you know, maybe Lana accidentally backed him into the knife that Cheryl was holding, and he was accidentally punctured.
There's a lot of choices to this one, but so let's set it all up. And Johnny is a gangster, straight up gangster, mafia guy. He was associated with the mob boss Mickey Cohen. And this whole murder is maybe the most, I mean, she was a really big movie star, but since this murder, it's what everybody kind of knows her for.
Yeah, this definitely ruined her. I mean, by the time it was all over, the aftermath, I mean, she was tanking.
You know, so it all kind of, Lana got married several times. I don't even remember. I think it's like seven. But at this point, she had been married four times, and she had divorced her the guy named Lex Barker, who had he was in Tarzan of the Apes. And one of the things about Johnny is that he was very jealous, and Lana had to go film a movie in London. And this is one of the things that I had written a blind about. But she went and filmed in England this movie called Another Time, Another Place. And she was starring – it starred Sean Connery, actually, alongside her. He was about a decade younger than her at that time. And he played a war correspondent, and she was – an American journalist, and it's set in London at the end of World War II, and the two of them have an affair. Apparently, on screen, this affair or whatever, was pretty steamy for 1958, 1957.
So what you're saying is, like, it might have been steamy on screen and then maybe off screen.
Oh, I think it was definitely steamy off screen, too. I mean, we're talking about Lana Turner, who was not exactly known for fidelity and, you know, was married many, many, many times, and a lot of on-set romances. And then, you know, so you have this guy, Johnny, who is this possessive gangster. So this is 1958. So what does Johnny do when he starts hearing these rumors? And here's the thing. This is not the age of social media. So Johnny, I guess, hears about, I don't know how he heard that the scenes were sexy or that Lana might be doing something with somebody. I mean, did somebody really send a telegram saying, Johnny, Lana's having sex with Sean Connery, stop, or whatever, you know? I mean,
maybe, because he was in deep with kind of a lot of people. You know, he'd got into it frequently with Frank Sinatra, you know, over Ava Gardner?
Yep, he had. And I had a blind about this blind talked about Ava Gardner, Frank Sinatra, Lana Turner, and Sean Connery because, yeah, he, you know, Frank Sinatra was basically mobbed up too. And, you know, so.
Yeah, your blind was amazing. That blind was great.
Yeah. And I would read it now, except for the fact that I think I just read it on a podcast like a month ago. So you can find it. It's Sean Connery Blind, and it's not the long one where I spent several days with him, although that's very good too. So he flies to London from LA in 1958. Because he had heard that, you know, they were hanging out and they were dining at restaurants and things like that. So without telling anybody, he just showed up on the film set in London. And nobody knew he was coming. And he had a gun.
You know, it's the United Kingdom. You can't have guns.
Apparently, you could fly on a plane back then with a gun or something. I don't know. It was his gun. It wasn't a gun that he had picked up from some mafia connection in London. It was his gun. And he walks on the set with the gun out. Okay, this is not like I've got it in my in a holster or something like that. He walks onto the movie set with this gun out and threatens to shoot Connery.
Yeah, he's pointing it at him.
Yes.
Talk about gutsy.
I know. And so what does Sean Connery do? He does a Bond thing. You know,
he does.
He grabs the gun from Johnny's hands and then twisted the wrist. And then the gun, you know, is gone. And then
he takes the gun away and then he beats him, right?
Yeah. And then Lana had Johnny deported from England. So you know that the things are going to be bad when Lana goes back home. And you know, and they were horrible. I'm trying to, there was something that I had read and I wanted to find the quote, and it could have been from the inquest, but I'm not seeing it, but maybe it was from Cheryl Crane's book later on in life. But Lana had told Cheryl that night that this all happened, that, oh, you know, I'm going to break up with him or whatever, and this is going to be a rough night. I just want to make sure that you're okay with it.
Well, yeah, because she was having a revival of her career. You know, it was starting to peak again, and she thought, well, he's real bad for business. I got to get rid of him.
Yeah. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention. On the set, he came on with the gun, and then he choked Lana Turner also. And you know, and that's the whole thing. And then she gets him deported. But so that was in September of 1957. So then they get back together. So she comes back from London, and even though she's had him deported, even though this guy brought a gun to a film set and threatened to shoot Sean Connery, choked Lana Turner, they reconciled.
Of course. And you know why I think that they reconciled?
Why?
And I kind of want your opinion, is that, you know, if you go back and you look at her father and how he died, he was supposedly killed by the mob also. He was gambling or something in an alley back in the 1930s, and then he was killed. So was this something that maybe ran in her family?
Or maybe, you know, she just, the mobster kind of thing. I don't know. You know, the house where she was murdered, you can still go see it. It's a lovely house. But so anyway, they get back together, and then this is something that I do not recommend for anybody in this kind of situation. They actually went to Acapulco for January and February of 1958. So they were there for a long time. My philosophy is, if you are with somebody who is likely to kill you or has threatened to kill people, has choked you, has beaten you, that perhaps you do not go to a foreign country with that person where they could easily kill you and then just get away with it.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, that theory held true in 1958, and it holds true now. I mean, there's just... It feels like, and you're the true crime expert, but I feel like there are a lot of deaths of women who are part of couples who, you know, on cruise ships or on out of the country, and they just get away with it.
Absolutely. If you want to get rid of someone, go to international waters, because they are not governed by the same laws as anything like the United States, and they will not do inquest into Americans. I mean, they say they will, but it won't go anywhere. Because there's too many missing. They just won't investigate it.
So then that brings us to March. And in March was the Academy Awards. And Lana was nominated for Peyton Place. And she also was presenting the award for Best Supporting Actor. And she chose to take her mother and her daughter and not Johnny. So when she got home, he beat her up.
It's kind of telling, though, right? So they spend January and February vacationing in Acapulco.
Right.
And then the next month, that you know, they come home. She doesn't take him to the Academy Award, so she must not have thought that much of him. Mexico must not have went over good.
I know. He also threatened to murder close members of her family and stuff like that. Okay.
He did.
So one of the things, this note that I wanted to, Sean Connery flew to LA because he had signed a contract with Disney and he was staying at the Roosevelt Hotel. And he actually got a phone call from a guy, another mob guy of Mickey Cohen. And it said that Sean Connery should leave Hollywood or he died or he would be killed. Whether or not that was going to be the case or not, or if he was just messing with Connery, but Connery did check out of the hotel.
He did. He started laying low. And
he
think he told somebody, you know, hey, I might get whacked.
Yes. So, you know, he didn't stay in any kind of hotel. He went to a house and he stayed with somebody in a house. That wasn't even in LA. It was in the outskirts of LA. That's how much he was kind of taking this thing seriously, because remember, he had taken the gun, you know, out of Johnny's hands. So,
yeah, and I guess he knew in the past that Johnny had shot people previously. So, you know, he knew what Johnny was capable of, and especially that entire crime family.
Yes, exactly. And by the way, if you're looking for the house, it's on North Bedford Drive if you ever come to LA. Anyway, I can't think of the number, but you can find it. North Bedford Drive, Lana Turner. You can find it. Drive by it. It's a lovely house.
730 North Bedford.
There you go. Thank you. and, you know, Lana Turner was, as you said, I mean, she was extremely famous at that time. She had the story of being discovered in an ice cream soda bar or something like that. And, you know, and there were so many kind of stories after that where I think that people just expected to be discovered in LA just sitting wherever they were.
Yeah, she made it look easy, but I mean, she was beautiful and she was talented and she did get picked up. And the funny thing is that her first role was actually in those crime dramas, those film noirs. So she knew all about that whole femme fatale crime mob type scene. And it's weird that her real life mimicked, you know, the movies that she was in.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I find interesting is when you read some of the things about the case, there's a lot of details to be had that aren't necessarily they're not in every single summary, like, or if you dig around, you'll find this little nugget and it's not in a different one, and there's all these little nuggets that come to light.
Yeah, and that's why when people ask me if they should read something, I'm like, you should read everything.
Yeah, 100%, because not everybody knows the story about the Sean Connery gun thing. Not everybody, some things that happened after that are not reported in one place, but they're reported in another. But one of the things that that Cheryl talked about later in life. Now, we're going to talk about the murder in a second. One of the things that Cheryl admitted to later in life in her book was that she actually had killed Johnny, you know, but at that point it would be tough. Her mom was still alive when she wrote that book and she hasn't really talked. She's written other books and she's written, you know, fiction books and all kinds of things since then. But I don't think that she's really talked about the murder except in that first book when her mom was alive. And not that she ever got along with her mom, but there's a lot of things that happened after the murder that makes you wonder necessarily about if we heard the whole story. So even if Cheryl was the one who did actually kill him, was it for the reason or was it the situation that Lana described, or that is, you know, the history of it. So why don't you describe, you know, how this happened?
Okay, so Johnny came to Lana's house, and it was a rented house, and that was on the April 4th, and it was a couple days after the Academy Awards. It was about 8 p.m., And he got into an argument with her because she did not take him as a guest to the Academy Awards. And they started fighting, and she claims that he tried to strangle her. And she asked him to leave. He went to the coat closet. I guess he had a shirt and something else hanging up in there. And she was following very close behind him, and again, he tried to attack her. The daughter either saw it or she heard it. She was in an adjacent room. And there was another family member there, too. I think it was Lana's mother. And he was threatening to kill Lana and her mother. And I guess the daughter had said she had enough. She was 14 years old. She went to the kitchen drawer, got a butcher knife, and came back to the room where they were fighting in. And either she stabbed him, just point blank, or he fell into the knife. It's two different stories. But he ends up getting, he dies from the knife wound. They even tried to bring him back through an adrenaline injection, also through CPR. None of that worked.
Yeah, one of, at the coroner's inquest, it was interesting because they called Mickey Cohen, and he was the first witness, and he was called to relate his identification of Johnny. And he said that I refuse to identify him as John Stepano Jr. on the grounds that I may be accused of this murder. And that's when he testified before being dismissed. And
yeah, that was like a circus, you know, to see that guy do all that. When I was reading it, you know, it was very descriptive. That guy wanted no part of the inquest.
No, not at all. And it was just... it was interesting that they even called him like that. Okay, so one of the things that you kind of have to almost think about is that Cheryl was 14 years old, so nothing was probably going to happen to her. Lana thought that Cheryl had actually punched Johnny at first. But realized he had been stabbed when he collapsed, and then she saw all the blood.
Yeah, but, so this is where the theories start coming in as to what happened.
Right. So the thought what Cheryl had said was that, you know, Lana had said, okay, you know, it's going to be a really rough night. Are you ready for it? Now, what we found out in this, I don't know if they testified at the coroner's thing or if it was just after and somebody talked about it, but there was somebody who said that the reason that they thought that Lana had killed Johnny because Lana was jealous that Johnny was having a relationship with Cheryl. And
yes.
Cheryl talked about later in life in her book, she did talk about the that the fourth husband and Johnny had been sexually abusing her. So I wonder if this mobster had any, you know, maybe Lana thought that Johnny was more interested in Cheryl than in Lana.
Yeah, I tend to think that Lana is going to be the one that was jealous, and she either stabbed him or she had the daughter do it just because the daughter was a juvenile and they knew that a juvenile would not be prosecuted for something like that, or she was less likely to face severe prosecution. I mean, she was taken to juvenile hall, but then, you know, nothing became of her. She became a ward of the state. They ended up giving her to the grandmother because they thought Lena was not.
Okay, yeah, so stop right there for a second. That's really important because this is somebody who didn't want to be with her mother. You know, but at the same time, Lana had been saying, oh, you know, we're close and are you ready for this? It's going to be a tough night and all this kind of stuff. And Lana made it seem like it was a very loving relationship. And it obviously was not because of the fact that she wanted to, she was willing to be a ward of the state, and be with her grandmother rather than her mom.
Yeah, to me, that absolutely screams that, you know, they did not have a good relationship.
And one of the other things is in 1957, she started going to school in Ojai, California, which is a long way. It is a good hour away, you know, in today's times from where they lived in L.A. So I'm wondering how much of a relationship there could have been between Johnny and Cheryl, because, you know, all of this happened presumably, you know, if she started going to school there in September or whatever, and this happened in April, was she coming back on the weekends? I don't know.
Could have been. I wonder, you know, like you said about the Lana's previous, like, husbands or lovers that might have been molesting Cheryl, and that might have turned her off to men, because as we go to look, you know, at her life as she gets older and what she goes on to do, that might explain why she made those selections.
Well, you know, maybe, but, you know, I am of the belief 100% that, you know, you were born gay or not, and it's a genetic thing. And Lana, I mean, Cheryl addressed that.
Had she always been out, though? Because, you know, she's really
out now.
Okay,
she said that she came out to her mom when she was she knew that she was gay from the time that she was six, but that she came out when she was 13, I think, so the year before all this happened. And in the book, she had talked to her mother that she was going to talk about this in the book, and her mom said, "Don't you realize what you're letting yourselves in for?" And then she apparently, Lana said, "You mean it wasn't something I did? It wasn't environmental." And when Cheryl said no, Cheryl says that she saw a huge weight being lifted from, you know, her mother.
Oh.
You know, so I think that perhaps, you know, Lana did think that. At the same time, Lana and her daughter, I don't think, ever really got along, because when Lana died, she only gave Cheryl like $50,000, and her estate was worth about $3 million in today's dollars, and she left most of, except for the $50,000, she left the rest to her maid.
To the maid. Okay, yeah, that's a telling story. Yeah, you skip your daughter for the maid? Yeah,
well, the maid had been with her for about 45 years.
Still, though, you're over your flesh and blood.
I know. So then Crane challenged the will, but then the maid, her name is Carmen Lopez Cruz, she said that the majority of the estate was consumed by legal fees, probate costs, and medical expenses. I don't know, but it's a very interesting thing. What I just, are you under the impression, do you think that, well, who do you think, first of all, did the killing? Do you think it was Cheryl, or do you think it was Lana?
I think it was Lana that got Cheryl to do it. I think she told her, "You're the minor. You're not going to face any type of prosecution. You know, I'll get you out of it. You know, just get rid of him," because, number one, she needed the career path to take off. In order for the career to keep taking off, she needed this mobster to go away. He wouldn't go away. He's being horrible. And then he's showing up at the house doing domestic violence stuff. So I could see Cheryl being in with her on that.
And do you think then that Cheryl was willing to do that because of the sexual abuse, or just because of what he had been doing to her mom?
I think it's a combination. I think that she knew her entire life, like you said, that she was gay. I believe that people know that they are born gay, and that she had received unwanted touches from people, or perhaps husbands that Lana had had. She had had enough of that. So when her mother approached her about this, you know, she was on board with it. And also, maybe there was a piece of her that did not want her mother getting beat up all the time.
Yeah, I mean, it would be painful to watch, and if you could do something about it. It's the thing is that the knife, right? It's tough. You know, what if he had lived? Would the story have changed? You know, that's almost makes me want to think that it's was an impulse thing, just simply because, you know, we're going to kill him, here's a gun. But if you have a gun, then does it become premeditated? You know,
that's a good question, because you do have a 14-year-old girl that goes to the kitchen and she grabs, you know, whatever she can, and she finds the butcher knife, and then she just happens to stab him, what, just directly in the right place of the liver?
Yeah. And, you know, and Lana said, well, you know, I thought that he punched her or whatever. And, you know, this inquest that they had, which, you know, there was an actual, a coroner's jury. It's 12 people or whatever.
Yes.
But these are 12 people that are getting to see Lana Turner, the biggest movie star in the world. And she had just been nominated for an Academy Award, so she could act. And, you know, I think that she knew that whatever she, as long as she put it, made it dramatic enough, that everybody was going to find it as justifiable homicide. This is what she did say. This is, I found the quote from the coroner's inquest. And she said that she testified that she tried to prepare Cheryl for a stormy night. This is the quote. I'm going to end it with him tonight. Baby, it's going to be a rough night. Are you prepared for it? So she had decided that she was going to end it. She also talked about that this argument that had started off in London. But remember, that was in September. And we're now in April. And they went to Acapulco for 2 months. And it doesn't appear that anybody really asked her about why you went to Acapulco with him for 2 months and stuff.
Yeah, but why did no one ask her how this all began to begin with? Because she just starts receiving flowers and gifts from this random guy, and he was calling himself John Still at the time. That was his anonymous, like, alias name. When all along it was really this Johnny Stoppinato guy. And the reason why he wouldn't give her the name up front is because he feared that if she knew what he was, it would scare her off. So for the longest time, she was dating basically John Doe unknown, and she was okay with that. Then he goes on to tell her, and she's still okay with it. So I don't really question Acapulco if she was, you know, willing to keep on with him after she realized.
This is something that also contradicts kind of what went on the set. She said in this coroner's inquest, she said that there was a running argument going back to the trip to London. And she said in their hotel that Johnny held a razor to her face and threatened to disfigure her. She recalled him saying he would, quote, cut you just a little now to give you a taste of it. Okay, but that doesn't really jibe with what happened. So he comes on the set. He's got the gun. He chokes her. Connery takes the gun, beats him on the head with it. And then Cheryl has him – I mean, not Cheryl. Lana has him deported. But now in this coroner's inquest, she's saying that they were in a hotel together.
And then she goes on to say even more about him that would make you want to stay away. He drugs her, maybe, and then he takes nude photos of her, and then he uses them to blackmail her. Is that why she kept going back, or was she just into the dramatics, you know, of life?
Yeah, and she said at the inquest that when she told him it was over, he grabbed me by the arms and started shaking me and cursing me very badly and saying that if he said jump, I would jump and blah. And that I would have to do everything that he told me, or he'd cut my face or cripple me. And when it, beyond that, he would kill me and my daughter and my mother. Why? Okay. If you know that this guy is extremely violent and you know that you're going to break it off with him that night, why would you have your daughter there?
Why would you have her there, and why would you have him come to your home? Why did they not meet at a diner, out at a public place? I mean, yeah, I mean, it was back in the 1950s, but still, she had logic.
Yeah, you know, and so, and then she said in this inquest, you know, I wasn't able to shield Cheryl from this. And then I broke away. She says, I broke away from his holding me, and I turned around to face the door, and my daughter was standing there, and I said, please, Cheryl, please don't listen to any of this. Please go back to your own room. And then she said that Cheryl returned to her room. And then Lana said, don't ever touch me again. I'm absolutely finished. This is the end, and I want you to get out. And I was walking toward the bedroom door, and he was right behind me, and I opened it, and my daughter came in. I swear it was so fast, I truthfully thought she had hit him in the stomach. The best I can remember, they came together and they parted. I still never saw a blade. This is what bothers me like this. So I'm walking toward the bedroom door. He was right behind me. I opened it. Okay. So she opens the door. So she is standing in the doorway. And you have Johnny behind her. And then the daughter comes in and somehow maneuvers around Lana and then goes and gets Johnny.
Yeah, for the mother to have been between Johnny and Cheryl, the mother would have needed to have seen the knife. I mean, it's a butcher knife, so it was not small. She would have to have seen it, so some part of that story is going to be a white lie.
Well, I think there's a ton of holes in the story, and it doesn't match up with, you know, what we knew happened. No, I mean, for a fact, what happened in London, unless she, you know, got choked in London, and then didn't deport him right away, let him come back to her hotel. And, you know, but she got Scotland Yard involved in it. And there was never any mention with the whole Scotland Yard thing that there had been this incident with the razor in a hotel room.
No, yeah, because I'm looking at the report from Scotland Yard. He was deported 4 days after, and she waited 4 days to report it. Why? They deported him on gun charges for using a gun inappropriately or something to do with a gun, and then also for assault. There's no mention about the razor or anything nefarious like that.
Exactly. So, you know, but remember, Lana needs to have some kind of story here where people are going to believe her. And just to make it as horrible as it could possibly be. And I don't think that they were looking too closely. It's a mobster who attacked one of, you know, America's movie stars. And the 14-year-old daughter stepped up and did this. Nobody talked about the sexual abuse at all until, let's see. It was outside the courtroom. So a friend of Johnny's had made a scene in the hearing room saying he wanted to testify. And he said it's a lie. The girl was in love with him. There was jealousy between her and her mother. He was a gentleman. That's more than the rest of you Hollywood people are. Well, not a gentleman if you're with a 14-year-old. But how about this theory that Cheryl wanted to kill her mom and ended up killing Johnny?
That could be a thing, too. Because she hated probably both of them, in my opinion. I don't think she liked Johnny or her mother.
Right. Because this guy, this mobster, just says the girl was in love with him. Why would the mobster know that the girl was in love with him? Why would he know there was jealousy between her and her mother? So did Johnny tell the mobster, hey, you know, I've been, you know, sleeping with Cheryl and Lana's getting a little bit jealous? I mean, this guy, it's just a random kind of story just to pop out of his head.
It is. Yeah, either this gangster was bragging about either he slept with her, raped her, or he wanted to, or it's just completely fabricated and they just wanted to smear Lana further and also, you know, separate her from her child, make her hate her child more.
Yeah.
You know, ruin that relationship. There's a lot of different ways you could go on that.
In her book, she does say that she, you know, like I said, she stabbed Johnny, but said that he was sexually abusing her, and the fourth husband also did. So Cheryl, after this is all over, like you said, she was made a ward of the state, and they put her in a school on Sylmar, which is over by Six Flags, if you've ever been, but they put her there for psychiatric therapy in March 1960. So this was, you know, a couple years after. So after they put her in there, she escaped with some other girls. They were returned to the school because her dad turned her in. And then she, like a month later, she escaped again. And they were made it all the way to Beverly Hills. And they were captured again when she was over by her grandmother's house. And then finally, in January 1961, she actually went back to the custody of her mother and her mother's new husband. and far from being happy to see her, Lana sent her all the way across the country to Hartford, Connecticut, to some with the Institute of Living. So, you know, just then what I think about when I think, okay, sending her all the way across the country, I don't want her around here. I don't, you know, maybe she didn't want the same thing to happen with this, you know, husband. I just, there's just something not quite right. And
yeah. It's just a series of, you know, the same thing repeating over and over again. You know, it's like Lana's not learning anything. And then she just punishes the daughter because she keeps sending her off when, you know, maybe Lana should just have selected better men or men that were not going to be into her child.
She, you know, tried to commit suicide a couple of times, and it was, she got, you know, arrested. The cops found a bunch of marijuana plants in the backseat of her car. She was introduced to this, to her wife, her now wife, that she's been together with forever, in 1971 by Marlon Brando. So, hey, I mean, Marlon Brando introduced me. I mean, that's kind of...
Yeah, that's a story to tell.
I know, you know, that's... So she's, you know, she doesn't really talk about it. And then when Lana died in 1995, then, of course, it all came back out again because of the fact that Lana had left all the money to the maid. So back in 2014, Cheryl actually married. Joyce LeRoy is her name. So, I mean, they've been together since 1971. So, I mean, a long, long time. It would be nice if Cheryl would, I mean, it's her story. It's her truth. But maybe a few more details. Because I would really like to know.
Yeah, I hope she does, at least before she dies. I hope she has penned something and maybe put it away in a vault or something. Or she plans to release something. You know, just tell us some more. Because, yeah, I mean, in the aftermath, they go on to talk about that juvenile court hearing and everything to do with Lana and Cheryl and how it, even the court system knew that they were in together. You know, they said that Lana gave one of the best performances of her life in lying and that Cheryl, you know, likely backed her up. So it'd be good to hear more.
And after the death, Johnny's family actually sued for wrongful death. And it was the brother, I think, yeah, Johnny's brother, Carmine, he said that that Lana failed to tell the whole truth, for sure, and that law enforcement had made up their mind right from the start that Johnny deserved to die, probably also true. So they filed a wrongful death suit for $750,000, which is the equivalent of about $6.5 million in today's dollars, against Turner and her ex-husband, Steve Crane, that's another husband. And the Johnny had a son, and he says in the complaint that Lana was responsible for the death and that Cheryl had taken the blame. They did settle. So Lana did end up settling, and for about $20,000, which is almost $200,000 in today's dollars.
Yeah, so you see them settle. She wanted them to, you know, shut up and go away, basically.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, her career was never really the same after.
yeah, so it just went down in history as a justified homicide. But
yeah.
Was it? Probably not. The LAPD just had way too many, you know, crime reports on that mobster, and, you know, they didn't care about him.
Yeah. All right, well, that is another week of celebrity murders, and I'm sure we'll find another good one next week to discuss. You can find Jen on Patreon at Dead and Documented. You can find her on Twitter at Mascara and Mace. Jen, as always, a pleasure to discuss this kind of stuff with you.
Absolutely. And until next time, I'll see you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.